97.9 FM, 1360 AM, along with Southern Season, bring you Side Dish with your host, Liz Cooper. Listen over the next 30 minutes as Liz Cooper brings the Chapel Hill Carrboro community culinary insights from around the world. From local farming to nationally known book authors, Liz shares an array of culinary tips. Brought to you by Southern Season, Chapel Hill's Landmark Gourmet Emporium. Landmark Gourmet Emporium, great for local gifts and delicious favorites. Visit them online at southernseason.com. And now, here's your host, Liz Cooper, with Side Dish on 97.9 FM and 1360 AM, WCHL.
Welcome to Side Dish. I'm Liz Cooper, and my guest today is Penelope Easton. Welcome, Penelope.
Glad to be here.
I'm so glad that you're here, and we have lots to talk about today. We're going to talk about your book, Learning to Like Muktuk.
Muktuk.
Thank you. I knew I was going to pronounce it wrong. That's I should okay. have asked to begin with, but that's okay.
There
that's
is no the correct fun. Pronunciation, and there's also no correct spelling.
Oh,
these words are in the English-speaking person's translation of a native word. They're not native words.
So they're not really native. Okay. Well, then I don't feel so bad. We will cover that most assuredly, but I want to get a little bit of background about you. You've led quite the adventuresome life from Vermont, correct?
Yes. Craftsbury, Vermont.
Oh, there you go. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about, we'll eventually get you to Alaska, but you were in the Army. Is that correct?
Twice.
So, oh, goodness. All right. Well, let's get started. Give me a little bit of background about how you ended up as a nutritionist.
Can I start out about what it's like to be a child in Vermont during
Absolutely.
The Depression?
Yes.
Because that influences all the other.
Absolutely.
My father was a physician. He and my mother had moved there with her oldest son. There was another son. And 7 years before I was born. But because he wasn't born in Vermont, he was the new doctor all the rest of his life. But I was born there. So I'm a Vermonter and I'm still a Vermonter.
Right.
You want to get this all straight.
I have good friends that are Mainers and anybody that's not from
Maine.
Well,
we call them maniacs.
But... Oh, yes. And it's the same story. It's the new guy in town.
But it was very different growing up. As a child, and I've been thinking about it when I was talking about this. As a child in Vermont in the Depression, mm-hmm. and actually the early years of the war, but the Depression came rather late in Vermont. And I lived in a little village of about 100 people, a common with a white fence around. You know, when you see pictures of Vermont, you see that. And we wore hand-me-down clothes, and we had chores. And nobody asked us if we were happy. Children weren't supposed to be happy.
Right,
they were supposed to do their jobs. They were supposed to not embarrass their family. Although I went to one-room school, and my brother, an older brother, third old one, was in the sixth grade while I was in the first grade. And he would come home and say, "She disgraced the family again." I don't remember how I disgraced them, but I did it fairly often.
It's funny. I was the youngest of five children, and by the time I got to school, they already had a preconceived notion about how I was going to behave and what I was going to do. And I would imagine from a long line of family.
Well, you see, I was the only girl.
Oh, dear.
And so I had to do all the female kinds of chores. And of course, I would have much preferred to milk the cows. And we were supposed to not misbehave. We were mm-hmm. supposed to do our jobs. And the only real difference between me and the other children in the neighborhood, little girls, was that I was the only fat child in town. Literally was. There were no other fat children. And I suffered from that. Yeah. I'm still suffering from it.
Is that sort of what made you go into nutrition? Or is that spurned your
interest?
No,
I went into home economics because I had to have a job when I got out.
Sure,
I did
sure.
not want to take home economics. And my mother was a home economist. She graduated from Columbia Teachers College. And they said, "You've got to have a job." I wanted to be either a doctor, and my father wanted me to be a nurse, and I refused. And the mud was so, well, I was up for a tuition scholarship from Tufts Nursing School.
Oh, wow.
And they came up to Vermont, and the mud was so bad, they couldn't get up to town to visit me. So I didn't get the scholarship. So I was safe.
I was going to say, that's a little bit of kismet for you, isn't it? You didn't get stuck in there.
Be a nurse. So I got a tuition scholarship to the University of Vermont and worked my way through and doing, you know, washing bottles, tending babies, cleaning toilets. And at those times, there was a government program. We got, I think it was 35 cents an hour, which was really very good.
And goodness. Imagine now.
Yeah. So, and my brothers were all thin and handsome and athletic, And I really was an ugly duckling. There's no doubt of it. And I never became a swan. That was a bad thing.
Well, sometimes that's in the eye of the beholder now.
I wonder where the beholders are. There haven't been enough of them. Anyway, so growing up in Vermont, I remember when I came home from graduating in high school, and I had was valedictorian, which nobody expected. They expected the salutatorian was going to make it because she was nicer than I was and studied harder, I think. And I had won this prize and that prize and so forth. So I said to my dad, "Aren't you proud of me, Dad?" "No." "Why not?" "That's what we expect."
Yeah.
And that was the way we were brought up.
Sure, sure.
We were expected to do things, to go places, to take care of ourselves, to take care of other people.
Yeah, I think the setting out expectations is maybe has lost its importance.
Yeah, well, now
days,
they try to find out if they're happy, if they love their mothers.
Well, everybody wants to get a medal. You know, that's a whole other interview.
Oh, no, I don't think they'll have us back.
No, I don't think so. But so what possessed you to join the Army?
Well, I got out of my four. Well, we'll go back to why I was in nutrition or dietetics, actually. Mm-hmm. The head of the home economics that year was a new person, and she was a dietitian. And she taught, she took a group of us and taught us dietetics. I mean, we had our choice, but. Sure. And so there I got my science, there I got the medicine, because there I got all the things. And it was able to do the writing and kinds of things that went with it.
And we should point out, dietitian doesn't mean somebody that talks about diets. It's nutrition.
I prefer the term dietetic. Dietitian, because anybody can be a nutritionist.
Sure.
At that time.
I think the mindset of a lot of our listeners are going to thinking of, you know.
Yeah. I'll tell you how to lose 100 pounds.
I'm going to go on a diet.
Overnight.
If only there was a pill for that.
Well, they tell them there are pills for that.
Sure.
So that to become a dietitian, accredited dietitian, they soon were called registered, had to have an internship. And I took an Army internship because literally I was too fat. They wouldn't let me in the civilian internships, which was very lucky because all the research people, the doctors and things, were being done in the Army hospitals because they were all in the military.
Sure.
I mean,
that's
we
great.
Were in on the original penicillin research and the penicillin diet. Of course, penicillin didn't make any difference what diet they took with penicillin, but we didn't know it at the time.
Sure.
And so those kinds of things were.
So you're definitely on the forefront of research.
And they were, yes, and also of treatment. They treated them, instead of having these diets that were so terribly restrictive. We had young military men, and we treated them as human beings rather than as a figure on a paper.
I have to cut you off here because we are coming to a stopping point. But this is interesting, and we'll take it right back up after our break. You're listening to Side Dish with Liz Cooper on WCHL 97.9 FM, 1360 AM, brought to you by Southern Season. Welcome back to Side Dish. It's Liz Cooper here, and I am with Penelope Easton. And Penelope, we were just talking about your taking the internship in with the Army. And as we segue into the discussion about the book and going to Alaska, I think it's important to talk a little bit about once you were in the Army, you really traveled all over the world.
I was stationed in what was then India.
Yes.
And we had to leave because of the revolution, and they couldn't tell us from the Brits.
Wow.
And they might shoot us.
So, I mean, I think people think, wow, Alaska, it's so far away. But really, you had been everywhere. It really wasn't that far. And culturally, you know, what could be more exotic than India? I mean, you certainly must have had some pretty incredible exposure to different cultural foods and those kind of things. And you talk about when you get to Alaska, and it's a story I want to bring up just very quickly because I think it's really interesting. Your first exposure to your boss at the time, I think her name was Helen, who sat you down and wanted to make sure you had the appropriate,
Christine.
Yes. Appropriate table manners to appreciate whatever was put in front of you. And
what she said was, if you can't eat anything you pull out of the common pot with your hands, if you can't eat it, go home.
But it's true. It's that ability to, wherever you are, appreciate what's in front of you.
Well,
and know that there's.
And if you reject a person's food, you reject him culturally.
Exactly.
And I knew that all the way along.
So, and it wasn't a surprise to you. You sort of felt right at home and you knew exactly that this was where you wanted to be.
Yeah.
So I'm going to sort of jump in because we talked a lot about your background and we'll bleed into that a little bit. But I want to talk a little bit about the book and sort of, I know you had some great inspiration for writing it. So let's talk a little bit about it, learning to like Muktuk, I'm sorry. And sort of the subcategory here is an unlikely explorer in the territorial Alaska. So what was your inspiration for writing this? Because you didn't write the book until you were 88 years old, correct?
I started it, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I had, Alaska was a bureaucratic mess. It was between, when I went there in 1948, it was after World War II, which had a lot of influence on Alaska, and before statehood. So nobody was really paying much attention to the stores. And it was also under the typhoid fever and measles.
I mean tuberculosis. Tuberculosis, yeah.
They have had typhoid there. They had disease known to man, practically. But it was tuberculosis and measles.
Sure.
And measles wiped out whole families. So that there was a real social, medical problems. And they all built in together. And I was a Vermonter. And I wasn't used to treating anybody as a second-class citizen. And here, the native and the native, particularly the native children, were taught and told and required to use only a white man's culture and to ignore their own rich, wonderful culture in terms of food and alternative medicine and all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And the schools endorsed this philosophy that to succeed in the 20th century, a native child had to be a white man's culture.
Yeah,
that was a real shock to me.
And you mentioned when you first got there, lots of gold rush people that call themselves sourdoughs that were new to the area. And really, you weren't exposed to the natives immediately. It was mostly white people.
I didn't see them. They were there.
But all the other white people
didn't see them.
Yeah.
So I even went to the native hospital to advise them what to feed them and didn't think of asking what did they eat at all.
Exactly. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. You said you did some advisory. And how do you do that when you don't know what they're...
Well, scientifically, what I said was correct. But
sure.
Culturally...
It probably didn't make any sense for them.
No.
So we want to talk a little bit about what is Muktuk.
Well, muktuk is what you would probably call blubber attached to the skin.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's little pieces of the flesh attached to the skin of the whale.
Right.
There is supposed to be a seal muktuk, but I never saw any. Mm-hmm. And it's a great delicacy. And it is a cultural thing for the Eskimo tribes, both the Yupik and the Inupiaq Eskimos, the two different main tribes. There are some 270 tribes in Alaska.
I was so shocked to hear that because it's sort of divided between four native cultures, but there's hundreds.
The main ones. When I went there, there were 100,000 people in the territory of Alaska. Wow. 50,000 of them, approximately, were white. 25,000 were of Indian, which were Athabascan and Tlingit and a few other Indian tribes. And then the other 25% was divided among the Eskimo, and I named the two tribes of those, and the Aleuts.
Right.
So you see, all those people could have fit in the stadium at University of Michigan that I had just left. And I used to visualize them. 540 million acres. And these people. So there was about, one person per square mile or something.
Oh, wow. Like so very spread out. So there's so much to cover in the book. And unfortunately, our time goes by so quickly. So I want to cover something that we talked about earlier. And that is your exposure to the whale harvest. And secondarily, asking you what your biggest challenge was while you were there. So I think they kind of ruminate into each other. I'm going to let you go ahead and tell the story.
Well, the challenge was, of course, to understand the culture and help. But the problem was finding a restroom.
We don't think about those things, do we?
No, we don't. We landed on the tundra overnight in a storm and we didn't know that we were ever going to get out. And here we were. We had to climb out of this plane. It was a Norseman, if anybody knows anything about planes. And hold hands in 50-mile-an-hour gale and still take care of our bodily functions.
Good. Yes.
And then at the whale hunt, I was the only white woman and I had on wool ski pants and a jacket and several sweaters. And the native women had beautiful long parkas that went down to the snow and they discreetly, because there are no trees or anything.
Right. You're just in big open land for
these
big ceremonies.
All these people milling around and the blood on the snow and moving the carcasses and stuff like that. And then so the women had their place to go. And, of course, men, you know how they are equipped. They
do whatever
anywhere.
They want. Yes, we all know that.
Both native and white men. So that was a big problem, but it was worth it, believe me.
Yes. So I want to talk very quickly. I'm going to go to a break here, but when we come back, I want to talk briefly about the whale harvest and the actual publishing of the book. So we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Side Dish on WCHL 97.9 FM, 1360 AM, brought to you by Southern Season. Welcome back to Side Dish. I'm Liz Cooper here, and I'm with Penelope Easton. So, Penelope, we're going to jump right along to your 88th birthday, because this was sort of a epiphany for you, was it not?
Yes.
Okay.
So I stopped dyeing my hair.
There you go. Okay, ladies, 88's the time to stop it.
Well, all these years, you know, I had had these yellow copies of my voluminous field reports.
I had
kept them. They weren't filed. They just ran around in the footlockers.
It's probably like my receipts for
and
tax time.
And I pulled them out finally and said, this is the basis for a book. And I started the book. And some of the nice personal things, like the gentleman friend's last names, were not in those papers. So they're not in the book. I might not have put them there anyway, but they're not in the book.
That's okay, though.
But the book is a story, uh-huh. But it's also a social commentary,
sure.
As I mentioned about expecting people to change. And then I did go back in 1996 four times with Janelle Smith, who had been a student of mine, and she was brave to take a 73-year-old on a research team. But then I saw the resurgence of pride in being a native of their cultural part.
Really sort of wonderful after being so shocked by what you saw when you first got there.
But I would recommend, I live at the Forest Duke.
Yes.
Retirement community. I think I told you. It's
an
ideal setting for changing your life.
Yeah.
88. All these wonderful people, talented people, great writers. I mean, real writers. I'm sort of a hack at it, but they're real writers.
It's a great book. Don't believe her.
And they read it. Some people read all three versions of it. And some of them even read the other extra correction. They helped with it. They gave advice.
Wonderful. So that's a real inspiration to sort of not only, yes, I want to write this, but now I have people that are confirming, yes.
And they go listen to me talk every time I talk. They'll probably listen to this even.
Well, I hope so. I hope so.
And then I was lucky to find the Oregon State University Press.
Right.
We sent out query letters. Everybody knows about those and how difficult it is to get a book published. And being chosen by a small but wonderful press, the University Press, was a great honor. And they, right from the first query, they were interested. Now, other people were interested too, but anyway, this press has been so supportive. And,
that's wonderful.
And they're friends now.
So do you any speaking outside of?
Yeah, I've done four here at bookstores. I'm going to do two in Vermont this summer and so forth. Yeah.
So you're still on the book tour. We had you at Southern Season and it was wonderful. We had it. Cooking class and book signing. And
that was fun.
And so we certainly have the books available at Southern Season, but you can buy them.
And also you can buy the rosehip preserves and the rosehip tea there. They are not from Alaska, and Alaska should capitalize on having some of those things, but you can get them at Southern Season.
We don't have the muktuk, but we certainly have the rosehip.
No, you will never get it either.
No, I'm sure we won't. So before we get too far in, I want to at least get one of our questions in that we like to ask every guest. So I'm going to ask you the dinner party question. If you're invited to a dinner party and you could sit between any two people of your choosing, who would you choose and why?
Oh, that's easy. The first one was really easy. I would choose Jon Stewart. I went to see Jon. My daughter got tickets for us about 5 years ago. Two grandchildren and my daughter and I went to Jon Stewart. And then I always wanted to go back and I wanted to be interviewed by him. And what I want to say to him, now you see he's giving up and I said, no, don't have a chance. I want to say to him that I am the self-appointed president of his over 90 fan club.
Oh, fantastic. I'm sure he would love it. John, if you're listening.
And we are a young group, so therefore we're not terribly organized. However, I have a suggestion for him. Mm-hmm. He needs more synonyms for some of the four-letter words because they would have greater impact if they weren't used as often.
There you go. I certainly agree.
and of course, I think his humor is wonderful. Yeah. And on the other side, I have picked a rather unusual person. And that is Dorothy Parker. And of course, she was 30 when I was born. And she was the political humorist. She did lots of writing. And she was a political activist. And she was kind of the inspiration for the Algonquin table at the Algonquin Hotel.
Fantastic.
And she had humor, biting, wonderful humor, and wonderful poetry. And I think it would be fun.
Oh, fantastic.
To compare her and John.
Yeah.
I might let them talk to each other.
Yeah, it'd make for wonderful conversation, I would imagine. Well, Penelope, it's been a pleasure having you, and hopefully we'll have you again soon. So if you want to read the book, you can stop at Southern Season. I think it's available as well on Amazon, but we would love to see you at the store. And it is Learning to Like Muktuk, An Unlikely Explorer in the Territorial Alaska by Penelope Easton.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Loved it. Thank you for listening to Side Dish. This is Liz Cooper, WCHL, 97.9 FM, 1360 AM, brought to you by Southern Season.